Welcome back, David Crit listeners. My name is Anya Luraman. I'm excited to introduce Motloki Nono. Motloki is a Johannesburg-based visual artist. Her practice includes video, photography, and printmaking as tools to investigate the intimate and violent politics that are implicated in romantic love. Her current body of work, titled Kissing Studies, is a playful series where she explores Black people kissing. Motloki aims to unravel the complex tapestry of love, scrutinizing how it is fabricated and manifested across diverse romantic narratives. Motloki was the first Black female recipient of the Ernest Cole Award, and she was also selected to take part in the Leipzig residency in Germany in 2022. She graduated from WITS with 5 distinctions and 2 awards. Please would you introduce yourself to our listeners and give us some context into your current body of work that will be shown at David Crit Projects.
Alrighty, thanks Anya, that was brilliant. Hello to everyone else, the David Crit listeners. That was a brilliant introduction.
Thank you.
There isn't much to add really, but yeah, I suppose it's exactly that. I'm very interested in what I term Black Romantic Studies, which is just an inquiry into how like love is not, particularly the practice of love, is not this natural, innate thing, but it's something that we're rather taught. And I'm very skeptical of how a lot of those lessons that have filtered down, particularly through modern media, right, mm-hmm. are very much Eurocentric models of mm-hmm. love and romance. So I suppose my practice is very much just a critique on the models that we have built our ideas of love and romance upon.
Thank you. Can you give us a brief history into your artistic practice and what made you pursue art?
I think it was a very natural impulse. It was a natural direction. I didn't know what else I was going to do after mm-hmm. graduating from high school. I knew that I had to do something. The very funny thing was that since no one in my family has ever been to university, and high school also made university seem like this academic fortress, you know, that was very much impenetrable. You had to try very, very hard to get in, like only 1% of the 1% of the 1% get in. So I wasn't too confident that I would get into university. So I don't know really what I had intended to do with my career, but I think it was exactly that, realizing that I don't know what I'm going to do, that I was like, ach, just give it a shot mm-hmm. in art, because I didn't, not that I didn't have any other interests. I think that I also could have gone into law. That was an exciting thing for a while, but yeah, art just seemed like a natural direction for me.
When did you start making art? At what age?
Do you remember? I remember my first engagements with art were very much through scrapbooking. Mm-hmm. I loved scrapbooking. There was this scrapbooking kit that CNA sold, and every month there would be a new edition. And it was very, very expensive. I remember at that time, being in my early teens, I remember it being like 200 and something, like 275 or somewhere there. And I remember it being a little bit too expensive for my mom. Mm-hmm. But she would still religiously buy it for me every other month, you know, not every month because she couldn't afford to, but every other month. And I just remember like cutting up her very precious True Love magazine and always fighting about that. But it has always been through collaging and scrapbooking. And I think that as now that I've gone into the career of art, I'm realizing that maybe it's always been scrapbooking and cutting up things and collaging and making images from other images, because I struggle with drawing a lot, mm-hmm. like with just starting from a blank canvas and like building that image up slowly, slowly, mark by mark. I just find that a little bit too intimidating. And it's also something that came up with the work that I've now done at David Crit also. I was printing with Spong Sen. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I first came in, he was like, no, we're just going to give you some monotypes and you can just like freely draw on them. And I hated it. I hated that part because I don't know how to do that. I struggle very much. I'm more like an impression-based kind of artist, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it comes from those very early stages. So yeah, I think my first memory of being an artist working in those ways was definitely early teens.
How did your residency at Leipzig inform your current body of work?
the Germany residency. So I remember the first 2 months, I really was just loitering around. Mm-hmm. It was summer. I was living like my best summer European holiday experience. It was only like in the latter parts of the residency, like by probably the second week of the last month, that I started to get into something. It took me a long time. I think it took me a long time, not only because it was a completely new environment, not only because I didn't really know what it is that I wanted to do, but I also think that at that time, I was struggling with finding an object that would really capture the dualities between romance and domesticity that I have always been working through, mm-hmm. you know, and I just felt like I needed an object that would translate those two spaces. And I think then I found the doily. I've always used the doily, right? But I don't think that I understood it in the ways that I started working with it in Germany. Conversations with Anna, I don't know, were a lot of conversations about like the colonial history between South Africa and Germany, and think like objects that have also become part of our identity as South Africans. Like, at which point does something stop? Not necessarily stop, but when does it move from being a colonial import and into being something that is very much intrinsically part of our identity? Mm-hmm. And the doily was that, because in realizing that it's a German export, it brought about really interesting frictions that I had been thinking about. So it was frictions between romance and domesticity, but also colonial implications of European models on love also, right? So there was a triadic relationship there between coloniality, love, and domesticity that I felt like the doily really fit in very well within there. So then I started just collecting some of them that I could find in the second shop warehouses in Germany. And there's a lot of that. It's very scary how much there is. And a lot of them have doilies. So I just started collecting those and I started painting on them, started printing their patterns and textures and stuff like that. And then eventually, as I just played around, something started coming up. And at that time, I was also starting to be interested in erotics, in love also, like the very thin lines between the pornographic and the erotic also, where those lines are, the sensual. So I was playing around a lot with that in my head. And yeah, then, sorry, what was the question?
How does it inform your current body of work?
Oh, yes. So at that time, then the print that I made for Leipzig was just like this red doily that had tongues inside that are just all licking each other. And mm-hmm. it looks very sweet at the same time, very sensual, very erotic. I think it was the tongues. More than anything, it was the tongues that I kept thinking about, you know, as like this organ that's very slippery, that's very yummy, that tastes, that gives, that takes. And then I started thinking about kissing, mm-hmm. I think. And then we found ourselves here. Yeah.
Okay. In your Leipzig interview, you mentioned a specific Tswana proverb about love. Please tell us more about it and if it still influences your work.
So the proverb is Mapeloje Laserati, which is literally, it translates to a woman has devoured, like consumed very literally, their lover, their body. And figuratively, it's a proverb that's said to women who are enamored by a lover. And I found it very exciting at the time because my earlier engagements with romance were through food, right? Trying to use it as a metaphor to think about the things that we eat, that we regurgitate, how well we nourish our body, and love does a similar thing, you know? So I was drawing these lines between particular kinds of food and particular kinds of romantic experiences and romantic conditions. So I found the proverb to be very fitting and perfect for the work that I was doing because it really captured the figurative side of it as like this romantic thing. You're deeply taken by someone, but also love is something that is a very carnal, carnivorous thing also, where you do consume your lover. Mm-hmm. Your lover does consume you, and that has implications also in who you are, on how you love, on who you become. It's something that really does change you, disfigure you in both amazing ways and also quite violent ways, you know. So yeah, I think the proverb still stands even now in my work, although I have moved quite a bit from how I would engage the relationship between food and romance. I've moved a little bit away from, it was a little bit literal, but yeah, the proverb still stands.
Do you think the portrayal of Black people in film has evolved or stayed the same?
I think it has definitely evolved. It has changed very drastically, and I think it's because, so what my practice is also very sensitive and careful about, it's not to say Black people are not the subjects of love, that Black people do not love, they do not know love, they do not know how to experience it, how to give it, but it is to say that we haven't been platformed, particularly in different kinds of media, we haven't been platformed as those subjects, you know. So it's careful about that. And so what the change has been over the years with seeing Black people as like these agents of love, it's particularly coming from Black people who are writing their own stories, you know, who are centering their own communities, whether that be in film, whether that be in literature. There is very much like a huge, huge platform, a huge archive that is now being built that does center us in those ways. And what has been very interesting to see is that when Black people talk about themselves in love, there's conversations, there's parts of it that's very much like a European fairy tale model. It's kind of like you just substitute race, right? But it's still a very unfamiliar, still quite problematic experience. The films that, and I think it's the surreal films more than anything. It's the surreal and magical realism films that, I don't know, they're still very sensitive and sensual and very honest about the real experiences of love. You know, they don't try to make up this fairy tale about like love as this thing that pronounces you whole, you know? So I think that's the media that I enjoy the most. The ones that don't try to be anything less and or more, you know, the ones that just come from the reality of romance.
Have you seen Malcolm and Marie?
I did. I have. I really liked Malcolm and
Marie.
I
also loved it. Thinking about this now made me think about that movie. And yeah. It was amazing. The script, the writing, everything was so good.
Yep.
And it's not trying to be anything more than it needs to be. Like, it's just that singular story of one night between two people. And I think it was just amazing.
Mm. I agree. And it's exactly that, right? That I think there was some critique about it also, about how, oh yeah, it again, here's another film that's depicting a Black couple as like this problematic thing that's violent towards each other and stuff like that. And I was like, I don't know if it was a violent film. I don't know if it was a violent depiction. And I also don't know if it was a depiction of a Black fight, right? It was a fight between a couple that was misunderstanding each other. It was a very normal experience. And I remember talking to my friend about it, and they were like, yeah, definitely. There was a night that I was up with my girlfriend the entire night, and we were arguing about bullshit, and she wouldn't stop bickering. And it was, you know, and I felt like that too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
How do films or art featuring Black love stories challenge traditional narratives and provide representation for Black audiences?
I think that the very decision to take a Black experience and put it at the forefront of romance is the biggest challenge to romance to begin with, right? To say that, okay, we haven't seen ourselves in these ways, in this case, so we are going to make space for our experiences in those ways. I think that is the first step to begin with. But I also think that it's a very long-winded thing that I've been thinking about, but I've been thinking about the relationship between geography, race, class, gender, femicide and racism and coloniality, particularly the social implications, right, of different social politics on love, right? I think it's something that is very much at the forefront of how I think about romance. Sorry, I lost the question again.
It's fine. How do films or art featuring Black love stories challenge traditional narratives and provide representation for Black audiences?
I think, yes, that's what I want to say. The last part, like, how do they offer representations for Black audiences? Something that I've been thinking about a lot is I make work that very much thinks about and theorizes the Black romantic experience. But I don't think that I make work for a Black audience, right? I think that I make work for an audience. I make work for people that are interested in love in those ways. And it's important for me to say that and to note that, because I think when Europe and America and the West were making films about themselves, they didn't stay in their communities. They very much, in these very violent ways, came to ours. They were also making those films for us being Black and people of color. They were making those films for us, and I think the romantic films in particular were a reminder, or felt like a reminder, that you are not a lovable subject. You know, you do not deserve love in those ways. So I think that to place us squarely in these narratives is radical in those ways, because it says, but we are, you know, and it's important that you see that too as the West. It's important that you see these things too in the same ways that we were forced to see those things. So I don't think that my work is exclusive in those ways.
How do these stories portray love as a form of resistance against systemic oppression and racism?
If I start talking about this, I'm going to take five. There's a film by Mati Diop. It's called Atlantics. And it's basically a film about these group of men who are being exploited as construction workers by their boss, who's getting orders from like these white people. It's like the typical exploitation regime. So these men go into the sea, and then they die, they get taken up by the sea, and their spirit comes alive in their girlfriends at night to avenge this very problematic boss. And I think what I really loved about the film was it didn't shy away from like the violence of death, not necessarily the violence of death, but the experience of death, right? But it wasn't a violent death. Right. And I think that for me, that's the thing about these Western romantic productions, is that they place us in these very compromising situations. They position us as these very stereotypical, violent people, whatever, you know. And I think that there's always been a historical relationship between Black people, a sanctioned relationship between Black people and death, right? And I think that in our efforts towards coloniality, we're trying to portray ourselves as like as people that are alive, right? Like, we don't attract death, you know? But I think what Mati did in this film was that we still are people that live under these conditions, and we do die under these conditions, you know? And that does have implications on the people who we love. But I think they showed that death doesn't have to be violence. The portrayal of it doesn't have to be violent and carnal in those ways. And yeah, and I think that is very much a mode of resistance, like saying that, you know what, I won't portray us in these violent ways, but I won't have a lazy depiction also that just substitutes the same European model. I just substitute race, you know. I thought that was a very brilliant film in those ways.
I'm going to watch it.
You should.
I will. What impact would you like your work to have?
You know what? It's not that complicated. I realize that art, we really do complicate these things by wanting to be like revolutionary and radical about our work. I don't know what I would like for my work to do, but I know how I would like my work to make people feel, right? I think I would like people to feel confronted. I would like for people to feel humor. More than anyone, the people who I work with, who I collaborate with, the people who are in my scans, who are in my prints, I think I would like for those people to feel like they are reflected in, not necessarily in honest, but in ways that they don't hate seeing themselves in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily saying in comfortable ways. I remember that with the scans, because they look very grotesque and awkward, a lot of people who I was working with, they were like, there were moments of discomfort, right? But it was also a welcomed discomfort on both ends. So I'm not saying that I would like for them to feel comfortable, but I would like for them to feel
a sense of vulnerability.
A sense of vulnerability, you know?
It's a very gentle confrontation.
Yeah.
This body of work, especially with all the colors, the soft colors, I think.
I remember that with a lot of people, I left the homes with them feeling like, oh, I didn't know that's how I looked when I kissed someone, you know? And it was uncomfortable, it was funny, it was embarrassing, but I think these are very humanizing emotions also, you know. It is the embarrassment that makes you human. It is the discomfort, it is all of these things. And it's a very thin line also, as someone who makes this kind of work, like it's a thin line to be careful of between making someone feel confronted by themselves, by parts of themselves, feel seen in these ways, because being seen can also be very embarrassing, you know. I didn't need to see myself in those ways. So one never knows how it's gonna make the next person feel, but I hope that it makes people feel humanized, you know.
I think it does that.
I hope so.
Can you speak about the responsibility an artist has regarding the subjects in their work, referencing to the printer's discomfort with layering the images together?
Yeah. And this is nice because it builds on the previous question. So with that, maybe to give the audience a little bit of a bit of background. So when I started making the work, the kissing scans, I was making them alongside the work which I was making for the Cole Award, right? And with the Cole Award, it's scans of people who are kissing glass, right? So it's a very much like a one-dimensional thing. And I think with the prints, I wanted to bring a sense of motion and two-dimensionality into the work. So then I thought that maybe layering two people kisses on top of each other would give that sense of motion. So I just asked everyone at the print workshop to kiss a plate for me, and then those became experimental pieces. And in the experiment, I started layering like one person's mouth over another person's mouth. And I think I wasn't aware of the real implications that that would have on how people felt about their kisses on top of another person's kiss. And I think that maybe I was naive. If you really want to do the work of humanizing people, then what that means is that the work that you have made is a real object in those ways, right? And then one of the printers came just to express that she's like, there's a little bit of, it's a bit weird, you know, that her mouth is on top of another. It feels like they are forced to make out. And that was very, very interesting too, because I didn't think about it in those ways. Then I just had to like let that go, right? I had to let that go because I can't ask you to contribute to my work and then it's like under these conditions only.
Mm.
I wasn't sad to let it go because I think for me, it just made me realize how strong the work also is, you know, that it feels real in those ways. I think that it was a responsible decision to not explore that anymore. But then what it did also do is that it made me feel like I do want to explore it, but just with sitters who are more comfortable kissing each other in those mm-hmm. ways, you know, because materially I'm still very much invested in those two conversations and that layering, mm-hmm. right? It's just not something that could work out with this first rendition of the work, which is very much experimental more than anything.
I think there's a nice connection between the value of consent within real life relationships and within your art practice.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a mm-hmm. nice correlation to have that connection between the two different aspects
mm-hmm.
of how love works.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That is very true.
What does the sense of discomfort or confrontation achieve when looking at such a private moment?
I think an audience would know better, because I think the other thing about making the work is that, especially when you're still caught up in the making,
mm-hmm.
is you don't know a lot of things. I don't know what's going on a lot of the time. And I think in those times, I rely on other people. Like the same thing that happened at the workshop with the layering and the consent. You know, it's very much like I'm in a, okay, we're making now. And I think it's nice to have people who are there to kind of like say, but what are we doing here, you know?
Tell us more about working with the team at Arts on Main. Is there anything of significance that you would like to take away from this experience?
So the experience was really, really lovely. For me, why it meant a lot was that I remember when I walked into the workshop, I was there to talk to Svo about wanting to make some prints and stuff like that. And then David so happened to be there. And at this time, I was making work for the Cole Award, and I didn't have a studio. I didn't have a space. I haven't had space in a long time. And that was very, very stressful because I need to make this work and I don't have a space to work from, you know. So then David just generously, in a very nonchalant way, just said, you know, why don't you use what used to be the bookshop? And that was really, really nice, you know. And I think that was a hint of the generosity that is just to come in the whole space, you know, whether it's with their time, whether it's with their opinions, whether it's with consistently being offered coffee every 5 minutes, whether it's like the snacks that are always there. But it is an incredibly lovely space with a very, very nice synergy, mm-hmm. you know, between everyone. And because I was then working behind at the bookshop, I was there on most days, you know, even when I wasn't there to print. And it was nice. It felt like a very good holding space, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the work would be what it is right now if there wasn't that level of giving that mm-hmm. was present.
There's an incredible amount of support
yeah.
in the workshop, I yeah. think. It's not a singular thing. It's a group effort between everyone, which I think is really lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole, I remember the day that I was there, everyone with the lipstick all over their face. It was really funny. I just thought I'd bring that up one more time.
It's that too, like how generous also with their collaboration, mm. you know, that, yeah, people, they were all just so keen to kiss a plate, to go through this very like arduously embarrassing thing. And that was really, really nice. Mm. That was nice.
What was your experience like engaging in such an interactive form of printmaking?
I loved it. I was actually speaking to someone yesterday that I've never thought, and I still don't think, that I could ever be a performance artist in any way, because I find it to be, for me, embarrassing to just put my body out in those ways in the public, for the public to perceive under this particular kind of like, whatever the performance would be, right? It's an unnatural thing. But the thing about these prints is I wouldn't say I found myself performing, but I found myself using my body in ways that I never thought that I would ever be keen to do. And I think the reason I was keen for it was that I didn't see it as a performance. I didn't go into it wanting to be like performative prints, but then they just ended up becoming that.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed very much being interactive with the work, like touching the plates, touching the paper, things to my body, things to my mouth. Back to what I was saying about being, you know, an impression-based artist. There was a time when I tried to just draw the lips, and that was completely hideous. I think that there's a sense of texture, of sensual texture that's present in the impression etchings that I don't think would have come up if I had treated the experience, the plates, in any other way.
I think it was amazing the level of detail that those plates were able to hold. When I saw them, I couldn't... I mean, it looks... You can see all the lines in the lips and the hair. It's just... It's amazing. The exhibition will open on Valentine's Day this year. Other than the obvious connection, what led you to choose this date?
I am lazy in those ways. There is no other reason except for the fact that I've always wanted to have a Valentine's Day exhibition for very typical reasons, for very cliche reasons. And it's because of the thing that I had also said earlier about when does something start becoming ours, right? Mm-hmm. A Western holiday, which is very much practiced this side by us, it's ours now, you know? It's ours in the ways that we have defined it for ourselves, right? And yeah, I think that for me, having the exhibition on Valentine's Day, other than the part of really just wanting an activation, an event to have for people, I'm going into it as a sense of research also. It's just that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where do you see yourself going from here? Will we be seeing you in the print studio again?
That would be nice if like there's more space to keep working. The printers, I would definitely love to. I do think that I also need to maybe this year take some time to go back to my printing press, which I didn't touch for the whole of last year. So I think for a little while, I'm just going to be in my studio figuring stuff out. But I would completely, definitely love to continue, you know, having a collaborative relationship with the workshop. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Would you like to say goodbye to everybody listening?
Goodbye. Bye, everyone.